The next thing I want to go over with everybody are just a couple quick tips and tricks that we like to instill to ensure that the session goes as smoothly as possible. So first off, I want everybody to make sure that your call is on mute unless you are answering a question. So the second thing, ensuring that the call is on mute, also, I'm going to get a roll call of everybody who has signed up for this who would like to actually participate in the group today. So participating in the group means that you will be called on to answer some questions. So just a really quick disclaimer about being called on to answer questions. We're all here to learn. Module 3 is what we're going over. We're especially going over upper extremity stuff. A lot of people find this really difficult. And if you haven't been able to go over Module 3 yet, understandable. This is a great session to kind of get you warmed up for it. So if you don't know the answer to questions or you just kind of take guesses, it's okay. It's a great learning opportunity. We're here to help each other. I'm here to help you as well. So with that being said, can I get anybody who is...
Hi, this is Deborah. I was... Hello?
Hello?
Hi, I was on hold for like about 15 minutes or so, and they made me hang up twice. So this is Deborah.
Okay.
I can hardly hear anybody.
Is that better?
Yeah, I'll put you on speakerphone.
Okay.
Okay, I got you on speakerphone.
Okay. All right, Deborah, are you willing to participate in the session?
Hello.
Hi, I'm here. Is this Deborah still?
Letitia is on the line. I just signed in.
Okay, hi, Letitia.
Hi.
Who else is on the line?
Hi, Kennedy.
Okay, so we've got everybody on the line. Okay, so who would like to participate? Who is going to be participating in the call today?
Kennedy would like to participate in answering questions.
Okay, so I've got Kennedy. Okay, who was that?
Sarah.
Kennedy, was it Sarah?
Yeah.
Okay, perfect. So I've got Kennedy and Sarah. Who else?
Hi,
Casey.
Okay, Casey. And then I heard Damien.
But I don't know much about it, but I've been trying to look at modules, so it's more or less guessing.
Mm-hmm. That's okay. That's fine. It's a learning experience. None of us need to be shy about getting the wrong answer because we're here to learn. Okay.
Thank you.
Kennedy, Sarah, Casey, Damien. Who else?
Ishani.
Tanya.
Ishani.
Okay, so I've got Tanya and Isami.
Yes.
Okay. Okay, so I've got Kennedy, Farah, Casey, Damien, Tanya, and Isami. Anybody else? Okay, perfect. So once again, everybody go ahead and mute your call. And I'm getting the documents out to everybody as quickly as possible. Everybody who doesn't yet have them. So has everybody gotten the Google document?
Yes.
Casey has.
Okay,
yes.
Perfect.
Tanya has.
All right, so everybody. Yeah, perfect. Okay, so really quickly, I don't know how many of you have had group sessions with me before or had group sessions with other tutors in the past. I know a couple of you have had actually one-on-one tutoring sessions with me. So the way that I run group sessions are basically we have our Google document. It's important information that's been pulled from the module, and it's been broken up into three sections. So section one, we're going to go over content from the module that's super relevant to studying for this exam. Section two is going to be a quick breakdown, question breakdown kind of method that I teach everybody. And then section three are going to be some tricky practice questions, again, relevant to the material that we've gone over. So what I ask everybody, please, in between each section, I'll give a minute or so to go over any quick questions that you have. So while we're kind of participating in each section, if you have a question, write it down and save it for in between. All right, so let's go ahead and get started. Section one is, again, important information I pulled from the module. These are questions directly related to upper extremity review type things. I'm going to call on each person who agreed to participate in the session. So, Kennedy, you're going to be our first person. What I'm going to have you do, Kennedy, read question number one to me, and we're going to work our way through the responses.
All right.
So whenever you are.
All right. You are working in an outpatient clinic. You have a 36-year-old patient who is a stenographer at the courthouse. She comes up to you with complaints of pain in her elbow, difficulty with typing, and some wrist drop. Her grip strength on her affected side is 50 pounds. The first question is, what is the most likely diagnosis?
Okay. So we've got some pretty basic information in here. Pain at the elbow, she's a stenographer. What kind of is the most important piece of information we can pull from this little write-up that tells us kind of what's going on with this client?
Just the complaints with the elbow, the difficulty typing, and the wrist drop. Also, her grip strength is below the norm.
Okay, so she's got limited grip strength. She's also got something else going on that's kind of important to note. Does anybody care to jump in and help Kennedy out a little bit with a little tidbit of information in there that's kind of important?
Wrist drop?
Yes, the wrist drop. Really awesome. I don't know who just answered that, but thank you. So we've got some wrist drop going on. So, Kennedy, what does that tell us when we have wrist drop? What's affecting, or what does that kind of cue us into?
I would think radial nerve palsy because it's affecting the extensors.
Yes, we've got something going on with the radial nerve. So radial nerve palsy, remember, is something that generally occurs after we've had an acute injury of some sort. So radial nerve palsy can be super common with people who have been in, like, an accident, a motor vehicle accident, a motorcycle accident. They've fallen and they've really hung on with their arm, and that radial nerve has gotten like stretched out or compressed from that acute injury. So it's definitely probably not a radial nerve palsy per se, but we definitely know we've got something going on with the radial nerve. So what do we think could be going on? This is a repetitive strain injury, as we've seen by the person needing, because they're a stenographer at the courthouse in the same position every day. We've got that repetitive kind of movement going on. So what do we think it could be?
Cumulative trauma.
So it's definitely a cumulative trauma. What specifically?
Cumulative trauma of the radial nerve.
Yeah, so that's a really great guess. So it's actually called radial tunnel syndrome, what we've got going on here. This is a diagnosis that we don't talk about a ton in school. I feel like when we are talking about these cumulative trauma disorders or repetitive strain injuries, we kind of, what comes to mind is carpal tunnel syndrome or cubital tunnel syndrome or medial or lateral epicondylitis. We don't really talk about radial tunnel syndrome. So radial tunnel syndrome, we get a compression of the radial nerve. It's not through an acute injury, though. It's from an overuse. So compression of the radial nerve at the elbow, and that's caused by swelling. And there could be some maybe micro tears at that muscle attachment that also are going to cause increased inflammation and pressing on that nerve. Very good. Okay, so next one, Kennedy, go ahead and continue on for us.
Question B is, which assessments would be best?
So what do you think?
I don't know.
Does anybody care to jump in and help out? What assessments would we be using for this client?
Would Minnesota possibly do that? To her ability to kind of like supinate and pronate. Would that be a possible one?
Yep, we definitely could use the Minnesota for sure. So that's a nice standardized assessment. What other assessments could we be using here?
Hmm.
So there's a big one that we kind of already use, and that's a grip strength. So a grip strength is a really nice objective measure to compare good side to bad side and also to measure progress. We've got range of motion measurements. Those are also going to be very important. And we've got manual muscle test measurements as well. So those are all going to be super useful assessments. So Kennedy, go ahead and the next one, please.
What are some treatment options?
All right, treatment options. So what comes to mind first for somebody with a wrist drop?
A dynamic extension foot. But
yeah,
that would be more radial metrology.
Yeah. So certainly we can treat it in the same manner. So when we're talking about splints for wrist drop and radial nerve injury, we need to get that wrist into some sort of extension. We also need to make sure the fingers, the MCPs, the DIPs, and the PIPs, we need to make sure those are all supported as well. So depending on where her thumb function is, and depending what her MCP function, we're going to need to have slight extension in those as well. Now, this splint, since she does have compression of the radial nerve at the elbow, how high up do we want this splint to go?
Does it need to be a long arm splint as well?
Yeah, we could definitely make this a long arm splint to give her that rest at the elbow that she needs. So this woman is a stenographer at the courthouse. So anybody who's not super familiar with it, people who take all the notes during trials or hearings or anything like that. So she's literally, her elbows are flexed in that same position all day. So we want to encourage her to rest to that elbow. So we definitely might want to include the elbow at least acutely or initially into this splint. All right, very good, Kennedy. Thank you so much for participating. I appreciate taking that rest. All right, let's go on to the next one, please, for me, Sarah.
Okay, so let me just read it on over. You are working with a different patient who complains of pain at her elbow and wrist. She describes numbness and tingling down her arm into the fingers. She has decreased grip strength and decreased range of motion.
All right, Sarah. So what's a little different about this situation compared to the one before? What do we have going on?
She has pain at both the elbow and the wrist, mm-hmm. whereas mainly last time it was just the elbow with the wrist
mm-hmm.
drop. So I would think that's important. The numbness and tingling, for sure, down the arms of the fingers.
Good. So those are
some big differences. Increased grip strength, yeah.
Yeah, so those are some pretty big differences. So whenever we have numbness or tingling down the hand and the fingers, where does our mind automatically jump to for a possible diagnosis?
A nerve injury?
Some sort of nerve injury, some sort of compression. Mm-hmm. And what nerve injury or what compression of the nerve is most common to get numbness and tingling down our fingers? What diagnosis?
Well, it doesn't say what fingers, because that's kind of what I was looking for, because I was going to,
mm-hmm.
I was, for some reason, anticipating it to say, like, in the fourth and fifth fingers, and I was going to say ulnar nerve, but I have a feeling that's
mm-hmm.
not it.
Yeah, so with this question, I accept either cubital tunnel syndrome as a possible diagnosis or carpal tunnel syndrome. So the answer I'm really going for here is carpal tunnel syndrome. So you're going to get numbness and tingling with carpal tunnel syndrome. You could also potentially get numbness and tingling in the fourth and fifth finger, as Sarah has stated, with cubital tunnel syndrome. But for the sake of this conversation, let's just talk about carpal tunnel syndrome. So, Sarah, what first comes to mind as treatment options for carpal tunnel syndrome?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you for a second. We're going with carpal tunnel?
Yes.
Okay, so for carpal tunnel, the thumb, you know, first, second, and radial half of the ring are affected. For treatment, you want to do, I know you want to do a wrist splint in neutral.
Mm-hmm. What's neutral? What degrees are neutral? Let's talk about that.
Great. I'm not entirely
Anybody
sure.
Care to jump
Isn't
in?
This,
Zero to 50. What is this, the 0 degrees extension?
Yeah, 0 to 15. I think, Sarah, you kind of guessed that, and then we had a couple people jump in and let us know. 0 to 15 degrees is going to be risk neutral, which is slight extension. So 20 degrees extension is going to be kind of optimal when we want someone in a little bit of extension, so you get them a little bit past neutral, right? So for that split we made for the previous client with the wrist drop, we would probably want them in 20 degrees of extension, not quite neutral. So in this situation, we definitely want wrist in neutral. So
okay.
This is a wrist pop-up split. It's the most common splint associated with carpal tunnel syndrome. We're going to get that wrist in neutral. The splint's going to end kind of at that nice, that senior eminence or that border. So our MCP can kind of flex, and there's no pain, redness, or anything like that. All right, very good. So which assessments are you going to add to this person? So previously we talked about range of motion, MMP. We talked about grip strength. We talked about the Minnesota. What other standardized assessment could we add to somebody who has numbness and tingling?
For carpal tunnel, the Tinel's test and the Thaline test, would those be?
Okay. Yep, so definitely we could do the Tinel's test. Let's talk about that. What is that?
That is when you kind of tap along the nerve from distal to proximal, kind of starting at like the finger.
Okay.
And if the person experiences numbness and tingling along that range, you kind of can assume that that's the nerve involved, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we're gonna tap right over the dorsal aspect of the wrist. If we get zinging or numbness or pain that shoots down into those fingers, we know that's a positive. That's a positive signal, and they could potentially have carpal tunnel syndrome. So what else?
I also have a Thaline test, however you pronounce it, but I'm not sure if that would also be a one to use or not.
Yeah, for sure, the Thaline test, definitely. So we're going to compress or squeeze for the Thaline sign. Go ahead and tell me how we're going to reproduce that or how we're going to give it.
So the person is going to flex their wrist. And they can press the dorsal aspects of their wrist together.
Mm-hmm.
And if they experience the numbness or tingling, that's how you know it's also positive.
Yeah.
A test for, you know, carpal tunnel.
So we're putting the backs of both of our hands together. We're flexing our wrist in, and it's almost like a reverse prayer position. So if we can reproduce numbness and tingling and pain, that's a positive Thaline. So we've got Tinel's, we've got Thaline. What's another test that we can do, an objective measure for numbness and tingling?
Anesthesiometer or monofilament test?
Yes, exactly. The anesthesiometer, the Semmes-Weinstein monofilament test, that is an objective assessment. And we have one more assessment that I'm thinking of that we can use with sensation, especially on the hands and the arms. And what is that? Can you think of that?
The motor pickup test.
Okay. How about the 2-point discrimination?
Okay.
Okay, perfect. Awesome. Sarah, thank you so much. That was wonderful. Let's go ahead and move on to number 3. Casey, why don't you go ahead and take number 3 for me, please?
So, cubital tunnel, described cubital tunnel syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the ulnar nerve in the elbow.
Mm-hmm.
So it's compression, and I think it's leaning on your elbows that causes it.
Yeah.
Yeah,
for sure. So people who are long-distance drivers, so truck drivers, Uber drivers, or just people who have a really long commute for work, people who do a lot of computer desk work and don't have an ergonomic workstation set up, those are all people at risk for cubital tunnel syndrome. Again, to go back to question number 2, we're going to get numbness and tingling down the 4th and 5th finger, and you're going to get a lot of pain that kind of radiates down that side of the arm. So, again, same thing for what kind of splint are we going to use. Fourth and fifth finger, we're going to want to get those into some extension, especially if they're curling in. We're going to want to get the wrist into neutral, and we're going to do a long arm splint to rest the ulnar nerve at the elbow. All right, very, very good. Casey, thank you so much. And I'll go on to number four, and Damien, if you could do that one, please.
Describe the difference between lateral and medial epicondylitis. Lateral epicondylitis is tennis elbow, so that is a problem with too much wrist flexion or wrist extension. And medial epicondylitis is like golfer's elbow, and that is too much wrist flexion.
Awesome. Yeah. So one's extension, one's flexion. Lateral is extension. Medial is flexion. So with flexion, it's going to be where that common flexor attachment is. We get inflammation, micro tears from overuse. The same thing with lateral epicondylitis, the common extensor tendon. And when you flex or extend the wrist, you can reproduce that on yourself and put yourself in anatomical position, you know, lateral versus medial. So really quick, Damien, what are some quick treatment options that we give people with either? What comes to mind?
Pain and inflammation right off the bat, and it's an overuse injury. So just trying to make them comfortable and not do the motion as much. So if it's bad enough, some sort of static splint, I would assume.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So we're going to rest that joint. We're going to rest the tendon. We could do ice massage. So remember, we do ice massage for 3 to 5 minutes to one concentrated area. So ice massage might be really great, especially in the acute phase. Remember, the acute phase is anything from 0 to 2 weeks that the injury or it has been initially diagnosed. So ice massage for that phase, a static splint of some sort to rest the elbow. So that's going to be one of those nice long opponents or those nice long arm splints that really rest that elbow. They also have over-the-counter tennis elbow splints, which are basically just a wrap that go right over the common flexor or extensor attachment. And the idea with those is, again, we can put, like, some ice pouch in them and deliver that nice long-term ice. So that will be past 2 weeks when we're out of the acute phase and we're getting into more of the chronic phase, and we can use long-term ice packs for up to 20 minutes. Kinesio taping or kinesthetic taping also is another great option for people with tennis elbow. That, unfortunately, is not as evidence-based as splint and rest and ice use, but it still can provide them some relief, especially if the person is, like, let's say, a professional painter and they can't, you know, rest their elbow for 2 weeks while it gets better. They have to continue painting. So we have to think of these ways. How can they still functionally use their upper extremity and also rest it at the same time? All right, Damien, thank you so much. That was a great explanation. All right, we're going to go on to number five. Tanya, please.
Okay, number five, name the muscles that make up the rotator cuff. So I remember these as the sits muscles, the supraspinatus, infraspinatus, teres minor, and subscapularis.
Awesome. So that was great. So Tanya just gave us a great mnemonic device for memorizing the rotator cuff. We're going to repeat that for everybody. So it's going to go by the SITS acronym, S-I-T-S. So we're going to do supra and infraspinatus. We're going to do teres minor. And then we're going to do subscapularis. So this is a question that could come up on your test. I had it on my test. And they literally were so mean. They gave me an option of supra infraspinatus, teres major, and subscapularis. So it literally came down to me needing to know that it wasn't teres major, it was teres minor to get the answer right. All right, very, very good. Thank you so much, Tanya. That was awesome. All right, Bethany, can you do number six for us, please? Which muscle extends the thigh?
would it be the extensor pollicis longus muscle?
Yeah, so whenever we get these muscles of, like, the thumb or, like, the big toe or whatever, we know that it's Latin. We use the Latin term pollicis. We, mm-hmm. the word that comes before it is going to be, what is it doing? So we've got extensor pollicis. So two muscles that actually extend the thumb, we're going to have a longus and a brevis for some extension.
Yeah.
So a long muscle and a short muscle. So, Eshmi, I'm actually going to have you take the next one as well. Which muscle abducts the thumb?
It would just be the abductor pollicis muscle.
Yeah. So the thumb abduction only has one muscle, and that is the abductor pollicis longus.
Okay.
All right. Awesome. Thank you so much. All right. We're back to the beginning with Kennedy. Why don't you go ahead and pick number 8 for us? And I apologize. It must have gotten erased. So number 8 is going to be describe these grafts. The grafts are going to be a hook graft, a lateral pinch graft, and a power graft.
Okay, so a hook grasp is like you're carrying a briefcase. A lateral pinch would be turning a key, and a power grasp would be using something like a hammer to hold something forcefully.
Yeah, so what's really important to note about these different grasps and what they have to do with potential multiple choice questions or information we need to know for the test is going to be that every single functional grasp pattern requires opposition. So opposition is going to be the ability to get your thumb to your pinky finger. Our thumb is vital in hand function. So the only grasp option for somebody who doesn't have a thumb or doesn't have thumb use or doesn't have finger thumb to pinky finger opposition is going to be that hook grasp. So that's going to be just like Kennedy explained to us, kind of carrying a briefcase. That's going to be the only grasp pattern we have. All right, very, very good, Kennedy. Thank you so much. And I'm going to go on to Sarah for number 9, please. Sarah, do you have us on mute?
Oh, I was talking, but I was on mute, so that's not good. But anyway.
You're okay, no problem.
So if you have a burn to the dorsum of the hand, I would believe you want to avoid flexion contractors, correct?
Mm-hmm.
I think.
Yeah.
So you're going to want to have the splint in extension. I don't know the degrees of extension needed, though.
So remember, when we say extension, we mean path neutral. Yeah, so we want path neutral to rest on it. Whenever we say we want the wrist in extension, that means path neutral. Neutral 0 to 15 degrees. So when we want it path neutral, we're going to go at least 1 to 20 degrees of extension. So really, really quickly, I'd like to take a moment to talk about burn. So this is a quick little burn kind of track. So second degree partial thickness burns and third degree burns are pretty much the ones we're going to get multiple choice questions about, because those are the ones we as OTs are going to potentially be treating. So fourth degree burns, people very rarely survive. And first degree and second degree, burns, like a second degree non-partial thickness burn is just going to be like, what are they called? Drawing a blank here. Like, if you get a really bad sunburn and you get blisters, or you do get some hot water and you get blisters, that's kind of like the non-partial thickness second degree burn. Again, they usually heal on their own pretty well because that tissue isn't really involved. So second degree partial thickness burns, we got the two layers, the epidermis and the dermis are involved. Nerve endings have not been involved, so second degree partial thickness burns out of the two are the most painful. So with both second-degree partial thickness and third-degree burns, the rule of thumb is 72 hours after the burn, we can start a splint and range of motion regime with our clients. Now, star or a note is going to be if the client has had a skin graft, which is very common with third degree burns, we have to wait 7 to 10 days before we can start splinting and range of motion program. So third degree burns involve the nerve ending. These burns are not anywhere near as painful because they involve the nerve ending, so you don't really feel the pain that goes along with the burn itself. Okay, and you are exactly right. So if we get a burn to the dorsum of our hand, that is involving that extension. So the dorsum of the hand is the back side. So those are all of our extensor muscles. So unfortunately, we're actually going to want the person to be in a little bit of flexion for that dorsum of the hand burn because we want to stretch out those extensor muscles because we do not want scar tissue and adhesions shortening the tendons and the muscles. That will create a contracture. And that's what we want to avoid. So if you get a burn to the molar aspect of the hand, then we're going to want to put them into extension because the molar aspect of the hand is the flexion. It controls flexion. So we're going to want to stretch those flexion tendons and muscles out to avoid those flexor contractors. So you have the right idea, definitely, for sure. Okay. So that was a really quick side note for everybody to talk about burns because they know burns kind of comes up often. Okay, so let's talk about Baker vein disease. So is everybody, does everybody have their call on mute right now?
Not me, Sarah. I didn't know if I was still going or not.
Yes, you're still going, Sarah. I'm sorry. I'm just hearing a lot of, like, background noise. I don't know if we just have a really bad connection with the conference line or what. Okay, Sarah, let's go ahead and talk about Baker's disease.
Okay, so I know that it is also known as the mother's thumb because it's kind of like when you're picking up a baby, that ulnar deviation. Is it impacted? And the thing that I kind of remember as a test for that is if you, like the Finkelstein test, is when you pick up the baby, it's a very similar motion to the Finkelstein test, which is where, you know, you kind of make a fist and then ulnarly deviate. And if there's pain over the radial styloid, I believe, that's the positive sign from the test. And that's how you indicate
it. Yeah, so we're getting... Yes, awesome, Sarah. Thank you. So the Finkelstein's test is the one we use to diagnose potential Baker vein's disease. That's going to be tucking your thumb underneath your fingers and then ulnarly deviating while your shoulder is in a little bit of abduction. So if you get pain in that anatomical snuff box, then that is a positive Finkelstein's test, and that tells us potentially this person could have Baker vein's disease. So, Sarah, what type of splint do we use in people with Baker vein disease?
Is it a thumb spica splint?
Yeah, so we're going to do a thumb spica splint, and we're going to make sure that the splint includes our thumb IP. And why is that?
That is a good question. I'm not entirely sure. Maybe I thought the IPs were free. So that's why I'm confused.
So there is sometimes a little bit of discrepancy whether or not you should include the IP of the thumb. Why would you think that we would want to include the IP of the thumb? Does anybody want to take a guess or help Sarah out?
Because the extensor pollicis goes all the way to the thumb?
Yeah, so the extensor pollicis, so we've got the abductor pollicis longus and we've got the extensor pollicis brevis. So they attach past the IP joint. So when we're bending our thumb at the IP joint, we are potentially overusing those tendons as well, and we want to rest those. So that's why most of the time with Baker vein disease, we're going to want to include the IP in our splint, in our thumb spica splint. What's another word for
the
wrist?
Oh, I don't know. I was going to ask, should the thumb spica splint be, like, radially abducted as well slightly?
Or is that not necessary?
I don't think that's necessary. We're going to want, again, we're going to want our wrist in neutral. Wrist neutral is kind of like our measuring stick. A lot of splints have us putting our wrist in neutral just because wrist neutral is our natural resting position. That's most comfortable for us is wrist neutral, a little bit of extension. So we're going to have a little bit of extension. We're going to have that going up around the thumb. For those of you that can't visualize or are really visual learners, go ahead and just Google that to get a nice image. It's also called an opponent splint is another name that you can see it as. And we know sometimes with multiple choice questions on the MBCOT, they can interject or insert different names for things. So I know splints are a very big topic area that I would say students really want to talk about on the exam. So it's just very, very hard to talk about certain splints. Because you never kind of know what's going to pop up on the exam. So I invite any of you who have splints that we haven't mentioned during this discussion today and you have my email address, I invite any of you to kind of just send me those and we can talk about it later on for sure. Okay, so thank you so much, Sarah. We're going to move on to Casey. Go ahead, Casey, and take number 10 for us, please.
Okay. Explain the difference between RA and OA. So RA, rheumatoid arthritis, it's more of a like immune disease where the joint is attacked by the immune system, while OA is more like wear and tear. So it's kind of like it can happen on one knee, it can happen, while RA can kind of happen on all the joints.
Yeah, so RA, rheumatoid arthritis, is an autoimmune disease. It goes through periods of exacerbations and remissions. Some joint deformities that we normally see with RA are going to be to the small joints. Those are the ones impacted. A really common one is called ulnar drift of the MCP joints of the hand. OA, just like you very nicely described to us, that is bigger joints, and it's wear and tear and time. So really the only cure for OA when it's gotten into a severe stage where the bursa or the joint fluid and tissues have really worn away to bone on bone, is going to be a joint replacement. All right, very good. Mm-hmm. So we're actually going to skip number 11 and 12 for the sake of making sure we get through section 2 and 3. So I'm going to move right into section 2 just because we're already 10 after 3. We've got 20 minutes left, and I want to make sure we get through everything. So section 2 is a very, very quick tutorial on how to effectively break down multiple choice questions. So most of you are on this tutor call right now. I would say half of you are probably taking the test for the first time. The other half of you are taking it for a second, third, and fourth time potentially. So the one thing you can bring with you to the test, either whether it's your first, second, third, or fourth time, is going to be an effective strategy for understanding what information they want from multiple choice questions. So we can study content until we're blue in the face and have a really great grasp on it, and then get to the practice questions preparing for the test and have a really hard time getting them correct and not really understanding why. So basically, when you read a multiple choice question, the very first thing you're going to always ask yourself is, what information is this question looking for? So there's three different types of information questions on the exam could potentially be looking for. Number one are intervention-seeking questions. So these are questions where you're given a client with a diagnosis or a disease, and they want an OT intervention from you. So those are intervention-seeking questions. These make up the majority of the questions on the test for obvious reasons. Number two, these also fall under intervention-seeking categories. However, these are actually grading an intervention. So we're given a task, activity, or exercise our client successfully completed, and we're asked, what are you going to do for the next OT session? So we know we have to take that activity, and we have to grade it to the next level of difficulty. How we do that is we choose the measurable piece from the activity. So they're always going to give you a measurable piece, whether it be how many cues you gave the client, how many, you know, steps were in the activity, how many repetitions were in the exercise, whatever. You're always going to have that measurable piece. You choose one thing, and you bump it to the next level of difficulty. So a really, really quick example of this is going to be a question that says something like, you're working with your client on cooking skills. They made a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, needing minimal verbal cues. What are you going to do for the next OT session? Okay, So we focus on minimal verbal cues. That's super measurable. I know I got to bump that up to the next degree of difficulty. Here are my choices. Choice one is you're going to have them make a hot cup of tea. Choice two is you're going to have them make a fruit salad using a recipe. And choice three is you're going to have them heat a can of soup using the instructions on the soup label. So it's pretty easy to get rid of the hot cup of tea option because there's no measurable piece about that answer. So how, what are we bumping it up to? We don't really know. So then we're left with two and three, making a fruit salad from a recipe and then making a can of soup from directions on the label. Okay, both of those have us bumping it from verbal cues to written instructions. So, okay, that piece fits. Now we have to choose the activity that's cooking because that's what we're working on. That's what's functional for our clients. So heating a can of soup is not technically cooking. It's reheating something already prepared. So that's how we get rid of that option, and we're left with the making of the fruit salad using a recipe. Yes, fruit salad doesn't require you to heat or bake it or anything like that, but what we're doing is we're chopping up ingredients, we're mixing things, and we're creating a meal from that. So that technically is cooking. Okay, type three question that you might encounter in the multiple choice questions are going to be information seeking or what would you do questions. These are questions that are not looking for an intervention and not looking for you to grade an intervention. They're all those other pieces of information that NBCOT might be looking for you. So these questions can be kind of flat out really tricky, especially if the question just asks something like, oh, hey, give me an example of the CAWA frame of reference. And let's say you're like, oh, I didn't study that, or I don't even know that, or I'm unsure. So those questions can be kind of hard to answer. What I always tell people is focus on what you do know. Don't focus on what you don't know. So if CAWA frame of references is something you're super familiar with, disregard that and focus on the answers. And try to eliminate wrong answers first. Eliminate answers that talk about other frame of references you do know. Okay, very good. So very, very quick tutorial. Let's go ahead and jump down to the section three, practice questions. So on here, I have five practice questions. I'm going to start out with Damien. If you would read me the first question, and Damien, you and I have had one-on-one tutoring sessions together, so you definitely have the breaking the question down kind of down pat. I'm going to have you read it, Damien, and then I'm going to ask you questions about the question, and I'm going to give everybody a chance to kind of answer it on their own using the breakdown method. So whenever you are ready, Damien.
I will do my best.
All right. Thank you.
Your client was involved in a motorcycle accident 10 days ago with resultant brachial plexus injury. He presents for evaluation with wrist drop and no active movement at the MCPs and thumb. Which treatment option would be best for the OT to initiate first?
Okay, so Damien, what type of information? Yeah, go ahead. What are we looking for here?
This is an sometimes you confuse me. It is intervention, but it's what would you do first?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's asking for a treatment option would be best for the OT to initiate first. So there's two things in there. First off, we know we're looking for an OT intervention. So some really quick tips and tricks. Make sure you answer or you choose an answer choice. That's an OT intervention. Make sure it's functional for your client. Make sure it's client-centered. And make sure you as the therapist are therapeutically using yourself. So we're not handing our client a list of home exercises. We're not training the caregivers on how to give cues. Those are not OT interventions. Those are OT recommendations. So those are different. So first off, we know that. We're looking for an intervention. Second off, it asks, what should you do first? So whenever the question says, what should you do first, what should you do initially, what should you do next, we know that cues us in, oh, okay, this is a sequencing answer choice question. So I have to put these in order from like one, two, and three. So that means maybe potentially every answer at some point in time might be something you do with your client. But I need to actually kind of, again, sequence number one, two, and three. So we always prioritize what we do by what's going to relieve the patient of any pain they might be experiencing. Splinting often comes first in our treatment progression when somebody has some sort of injury where they've got like a wrist drop or they've got a repetitive strain injury. So those are kind of first choice options. So Damien, what is this client's diagnosis?
This is a brachial plexus injury.
Brachial plexus injury, what's the client's problem?
He's having problems with wrist drop and no active at the MCPs and thumb. So that would
Okay. Perfect. Okay.
So we've got a little picture
of what's going on. Yeah, so let's go ahead and read through our answers, and we're actually going to focus on just getting rid of one wrong answer choice, and I want you to tell us all why.
Okay, have him complete radial nerve glides as part of his HEP. Fabricate a high-profile dynamic splint with wrist and slight flexion and MCPs and thumb and extension. Or C, fabricate a resting hand splint with wrist in neutral and hands, fingers supported. So since what I would do first, and the first thing I would get rid of is the dynamic splint, because I would assume that we would want him to rest before we move.
Okay, so this question was looking for an OT intervention. It was also asking what should we do first. So again, we know we have to sequence everything. So I kind of mentioned pain comes first with people. Splinting always comes first. So do we want to get rid of one of the splinting options right off the bat, or is there another answer choice that is more obvious, something we can get rid of first?
I would assume that that would be A then.
Okay, yeah. So A is definitely an easy one to get rid of. Radial nerve glides. So he has no wrist movement. He has a radial nerve injury. We're not going to be doing radial nerve glides just yet as part of his treatment. And plus, we're evaluating him. So, again, that might not be something we do first. That might be something later on down the road. Okay, so then we have B and C left. Difference between two types of splints. One is a high-profile dynamic splint. So, remember, when we use the word dynamic, it doesn't necessarily mean that there is a ton of movement occurring because we have the word dynamic. What it means is there's potential for movement, or we're controlling where the patient can move to. So, with that one, we have wrist and a little bit of extension. Remember, that means like 20 degrees or more. We have the MCPs and the thumb and extension as well. So I actually kind of like what we're doing in that one because of the nature of radial nerve injury. Now let's talk about C. What do you like about that one?
I just like that it was resting the nerve injury.
So it is very tempting to pick that one based upon, you know, a dynamic versus, you know, immobilizing or a static. So the problem with the resting hand splint as an answer is it's got our wrist in neutral and it's got the hands and fingers supported, which is totally okay. But with that resting hand splint, we don't really have a lot of room for the client to work on regaining extension in the wrist, fingers, and thumb. So a resting hand splint is probably best used for somebody with, like, hemiplegia after a stroke where there isn't a whole lot of return of movement. And what we are doing is we are supporting their hand in a good position at night or maybe on and off throughout the day so they don't develop contractures or they don't develop, like, skin breakdown or things like that. So the answer to this one is absolutely going to be answer choice B. Does that make sense, Damien?
Yeah. We'll talk about that one later, though.
Okay, yeah, we definitely can talk about that one later. Mark it for me, and we'll discuss it more in depth. This high-profile dynamic splint is one that we see a lot of, and all of you on the line, some of you may have come across this type of splint in your practice questions and kind of wondered what's the difference between this and maybe another answer choice in splint. And again, with this one, we like that dynamic option because of the nature of this injury. We want to encourage a return to wrist extension, thumb and finger extension. All right. Thank you so much, Damien. Let's go ahead on to the next one, Tanya, if you will.
All right. Number two, an OT is assessing a client who presents with shoulder pain.
The OT has the client flex their shoulder and elbow to 90 degrees concurrently. They then internally rotate the humerus on the glenoid, at which the point the OT provides slight overpressure. Which special testing is this describing?
All right, Tanya, you picked a doozy, or I picked a doozy for you. So what type of information or what type of question is this? Is it intervention seeking, grading an intervention, or is it information, or what would you do?
Possibly have, like, intervention since they're doing a test to, like, ascertain what's
so
going on.
Yeah, so that's a special test they're doing, so you could think of it as intervention seeking, but it's also kind of information seeking, because if you look at the answers, you've got empty can test, Hawkins, Kennedy, and speed test. You've got like three special tests that are used primarily for the shoulder. I can't promise you a question like this won't be on the exam as far as those information seeking questions. And those information seeking questions can be tricky, especially if you're not super familiar. So for everybody on the call right now who isn't familiar with each one of these special tests, go to a legitimate YouTube site and look these up so you can get a visual of what's going on. It's really hard to describe these tests. And that's another reason why this MBCOT exam can be hard for visual learners, because oftentimes it is written on paper and you're like, okay, what does that mean? So I always encourage everybody, as much as possible when you're at your Prometric Center taking your exam, do the position it's describing to the best of your ability without having one of the testers come over and be like, oh, you can't do that. So we're going to put our, in this question, we've got our shoulder and elbow to 90. We're internally rotating, and the therapist is providing a little bit of pressure. All right, Tanya, what can we get rid of? What special test is pretty easy right off the bat that we know this isn't really describing, even if you're not super familiar with the special test listed?
The empty can test.
Yes, I was so happy you chose that. That's the easiest one on this list if you're not super familiar. The empty can test is literally holding out your arm and taking your thumb and dipping it down as if you're emptying a can. So this is not describing that. So this is exactly an example of how we're going to get close to our answer with a question that's really hard or has information that maybe we're not super familiar with. So we've got the empty can test. So, Tanya, do you know the difference between Hawkins, Kennedy, and speed test?
Not really. I know, like, my initial is to cut out the speed test just since they're having pain. I probably wouldn't want to have something like that, but I don't know the, like, exact differences between the two.
Yeah. So the answer is going to be the Hawkins-Kennedy test. So with the speed test, just think of your arms being supinated, completely extended out in front of you. And we're bringing it up through the nice arc of range of motion in that way. And that has our arms straight like the empty can test, and this doesn't have our arms straight, so that kind of leaves us with Hawkins Kennedy, which is what this is describing.
Okay.
All right, Tom, thank you so much. That was a really tricky question. I'm glad you took a stab at it, and you did great.
Thank you.
All right. You're welcome. Next one is Ashmi. I'm going to have you read question number 3, please.
Okay. Your client presents to you with scapular winging and difficulty with forward flexion. Their manual muscle test score for shoulder internal rotation is 4-. Which muscle is the likely culprit?
Another tough one. Two tough ones back to back. All right. So tell me, what type of information is this question looking for? Is it looking for an intervention, grading an intervention, or information?
I would say information.
Yeah, information. And kind of you look at the answers again, and you're kind of like, okay, I've got to know which each one of these muscles did. So
yeah.
The question has the client has scapular winging. So that's a super important clue. So the difficulty with forward flexion and the MMT score for internal rotation is, are we worried about somebody with internal rotation of a 4-, a score of that? Is that really a huge concern?
Not really, no.
Not really. 4- is fine. They've got full range of motion. Mm-hmm. They've got resistance against gravity. That's okay. That's what's kind of thrown in there. That's question fluff. And I call question fluff like information not super important. So scapular winging, Do you care to take a guess at which muscle is the culprit for scapular winging?
I would say the serratus anterior.
Yeah, serratus anterior. That is the muscle. Star that, underline, highlight it. Scapular winging, serratus anterior, long thoracic nerve.
Mm-hmm.
So I have seen those on questions. All right, Ashmi, thank you so much. That was a tricky one. So pectoralis minor was an easy one to kind of throw out. Pectoralis minor doesn't really have a lot to do with our scapula. And then we have subscapularis, which is kind of tempting. But again, our subscapula, really, it has nothing to do with keeping our scapula from winging. Ashmi, thank you so much. Okay, back to the top of our list with committee. Let's go on with number four, please.
All right, number four, you are treating a client with a diagnosis of decorvans tenosynovitis. You fabricated a thumb spike splint, given them gentle strengthening exercises for their home exercise program, and advised them to ice and rest intermittently throughout the day. They report they are still experiencing 7 out of 10 pain with use and 5 out of 10 pain at rest. Which intervention would be the best to implement? A is perform a work tolerance screen. B, provide them with a TENS unit to use at home. Or C, suggest they follow up with their PCP to discuss surgical intervention and possibly RX pain medication.
All right, Kennedy, what are you thinking?
I would go with B just because TENS is really the only one that I see on there that deals with pain. So.
Okay. All right. Yeah. So let's talk about this one. This is an intervention-seeking question. So remember, whenever we get a question, the first rule of thumb when an intervention is make sure we choose an OT intervention. So some OT intervention things to remember. First off, it has to be functional. Always, always, always functional. That is MBCOT's main goal, is that we as OTs look like OTs when we're working with our clients. When we think of functional, think of how does this relate to our clients' everyday life? What component of that exercise or activity relates to their everyday life? So providing our client with a TENS unit, unfortunately, yes, it treats the pain, but it doesn't have that functional component. It's just kind of giving them a machine and saying, go ahead and take this home and work on your pain. So while that is a very luring answer, and I totally understand why you chose that, it unfortunately isn't the best answer with this question. So we already know following up with their PCP to talk about surgical intervention and prescription pain meds, that is totally not an OT intervention either. That's just us, like, giving them a recommendation, and we know that's out. So then we're left with performing a work tolerance screen. So work tolerance screen actually might be the next step. Because why? Why would we do a work tolerance screen with somebody with decorvans disease?
Because they're experiencing so much pain that it's going to interfere with their work activities.
Well, or their work activities might be what's causing them the pain, even though we've insinuated all of these other treatment options. So it might be they're doing a repetitive brain injury type thing at work, and it's just a simple ergonomic fix. Might be, so let's pretend this is a daycare provider. So decorvans was described by us previously as mommy thumb or, you know, mommy hands. So maybe this person is a daycare provider and they have like two infants in their house and two toddlers and they're carrying these kids around all day. And we do a work tolerance screen and we say, oh, now I see why you're not getting better, because you're not really resting and you're still using those poor postures and poor positions throughout the day. So that might give us a better point to work with them. And, again, that's an OT intervention. All right. Thank you so much, Kennedy. That was a really tricky one, but I'm glad that we were able to kind of discuss the trick of that. All right. Sarah, you're going to end the day for us with number five, please.
Okay. So your client underwent a rotator cuff repair 4 weeks ago for a subscapularis pinning. Their surgeon has cleared them for active range of motion exercises. Which activity would be best? So my thought process immediately is, what does the subscap do, which is internal rotation, correct? We want to kind of use that.
Okay.
So we'll see. Dust mopping the floors, wiping the countertops, cleaning the windows. I would rule out cleaning the windows just because it's an overhead activity.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure, though.
Wiping the countertops after dinner, kind of, to me, that's a circular motion that doesn't really mean internal-external rotation, but I could be wrong on that. I, for some reason, want to go with mopping the floors, but, because, like...
Yeah, let's talk about it. So,
would you? I don't know.
4 weeks ago, subscapularis pinning, you were kind of quick to jump to that as being important. So that actually is kind of a little bit of question fluff when we're breaking tough questions down. Now, if you're super familiar with subscapularis pinning and you're like, oh, yeah, like you said, that's kind of the internal rotation. I'm not going to focus on that. I'm going to look for an exercise. You can see where that's kind of hard, even for you knowing that. That was kind of hard to narrow it down. You're kind of like, I want to pick dust mopping the floors because you're like picturing that motion in your mind. So really the important thing if we're breaking the question down to focus on is the active assisted range of motion exercise piece. Because that's what the question's asking for. That's what it's looking for, an active assistive exercise, range of motion exercise. Now, you got rid of B right off the bat, which I was so glad about. Cleaning windows is not active assistive range of motion. You have to use some force. It's overhead, like you said, and we got rid of it. Then we're left with wiping the countertops after dinner and dust mopping the floors. And A, wiping the countertops after dinner, is going to be the correct answer. So we've got that nice functional component in there because we're wiping countertops, and that's like a cleaning or an IADL. And it's waist height. So after people undergo rotator cuff repair, we like to keep things kind of in that little diameter radius around our body, that waist height radius. So it's a nice, gentle activity. The cloth is providing the active assisted range of motion piece, right? So that's why that's the best thing. Now, dust mopping the floors definitely could be active assisted range of motion because if you're using the dust mop, if it just said mopping the floors, I'd say absolutely not because you have to use force when you mop a floor. Like the mop isn't providing that nice, smooth, active assisted surface.
Yeah. So I have a random question, I guess.
What's that?
I kind of didn't know what they meant by dust mopping. Would a better way to look at this be the waist height? Like you want to keep the arms close to the body in a way?
Exactly.
Like you're saying?
Exactly.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. All right. Very good. So we were able to finish all the questions. We kind of went through some quick tips and tricks for breaking them down and looking for our right answers. Just a couple of things I kind of want to give everybody a heads up or be end the call. So, number one, make sure if you are a very fast test taker, meaning you read through questions really, really quickly, make sure you stop doing that. That's actually a weakness. What happens is we end up rereading the question over and over again, and we get very fatigued, and our brain gets very, very tired before we're even done with the test. So that's number one. Do not reread questions. Number two is if you can identify yourself as a slow test taker, what can happen when we're a slow test taker is actually the same exact thing. We're slow because we're reading through the question too quickly and we're having to reread it over and over again. So instead of that minute per question, minute to minute and a half per question we like, we're seeing people taking 2 and 3 minutes on questions because you just get so unsure and you kind of battle with yourself. So those are huge areas of weakness to work on while studying for the exam this time around, whether it's your first, second, third, or fourth time. So those are just really, really quick tips and tricks. So for those of you who have more questions and have more things that you would like to work on, please consider doing a one-on-one tutoring session. It can be very, very useful in getting that special attention that you don't get in the group. So for everybody else, really, really quickly, does anybody have any questions for me?
I have a quick question. Oh, sorry.
Mm-hmm. That's okay.
So sure. I'm Sarah.
Go ahead.
My quick question was, I'm going way back up to the beginning when we were talking about radial tunnel syndrome, and you were talking about a dynamic extension splint. What does that look like? Because I've tried to look it up, and the images, they're, like, all over the place. Like, none of them line up.
That dynamic extension splint is just going to be on the volar surface. We're going to have the wrist into extension, and you could have the fingers in extension using rubber bands. So those rubber bands are attached to those outriggers, right?
Okay.
So that's how that could possibly look. Or it could be more like a resting hand splint. And I know, Damien, you're going to be like, what the heck, Jess? You just told me the resting hand splint wasn't the answer. It could be the resting hand splint type look or the dorsal blocking splint type look as well. But really, the first one I described with the rubber bands, with the outriggers, that's generally how we see those splints looking.
And a dorsal block splint is blocking extension?
Exactly. It's controlling how much extension we allow our client to have.
Okay, thank you.
You're so welcome. Anybody else?
The audio just kind of, my call just got dropped, so I didn't get to hear the answer for number three in section three.
Okay, number three, section three. Sorry, I just closed my computer up. Let me just look really quick. So three. So that's going to be the serratus anterior, choice B.
Okay.
And the long thoracic is what innervates the serratus anterior.
Okay, I see. All right, thank you.
All right. You're so welcome. All right, everybody else, have a great afternoon. Thank you so much for signing up for the group training session. I hope you got as much out of it as possible. And a lot of you have my email, so if you have any questions or want to schedule any one-on-one tutoring sessions, I am available to chat about it. All right, everybody have a great evening. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, bye.
Bye.
Bye.